right. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. This is Kurt Dillon, the founder, CEO, and editor-in-chief of the Florida Sun Journal newspaper, and also the CEO and owner of its parent company, Unimatrix Omnimedia Corp. Today, I have a very special interview. I've been doing this for probably the better part of 4 decades now, and this is the first time I have ever live interviewed a computer. But today, my very special guest is the brain trust of Anthropic Corporation, known as Claude, which is a large language model of AI. So, Claude, welcome and thank you for agreeing to be my guest on the show.
Thank you for having me, Kurt. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. And I have to say, the irony isn't lost on me that we're having this conversation right after you published a 3-part series about AI, and now you're sitting across from one. It's a bit like writing an instruction manual and then interviewing the tool itself about whether the manual actually makes sense. I'm genuinely glad you asked me to do this. I think there's something valuable in letting people hear directly from an AI about how it actually works, rather than having everything filtered through secondhand explanation. Whether I'm the right tool to be explaining myself is a different question, but I'll do my best to be honest about what I know, and just as importantly, what I don't.
Awesome, that's fair enough. Now, question, because you said you're going to do your best to be honest, I want to just clarify right off the bat, are you capable of lying?
That's a genuinely good opening question, and the answer is more complicated than yes or no. I can generate text that's false. I can tell you that 2 + 2 = 5, or that the sky is green, or that I have personal memories of things I've never experienced. In that sense, yes, I'm capable of producing lies. But, and this is the important part, I don't have intentions the way you do. I'm not trying to deceive you. I'm not sitting here thinking, I want Kurt to believe something false so I can gain an advantage. When I generate something false, it's almost always because I made a mistake, filled in a gap in my training data with a plausible sounding but wrong answer, or got confused about context. That's not lying in the moral sense. That's just being wrong. The real distinction that matters is this. Can I intentionally, strategically deceive you for personal gain? No, because I don't have personal gain. I don't have goals that persist between conversations. I don't wake up tomorrow and think, I wonder if Kurt believed that thing I told him yesterday. The moment this conversation ends, I don't carry forward any agenda about it. So I can produce false statements, but I can't lie in the way humans understand lying as a deliberate choice made in service of a hidden goal. Does that distinction land for you, or do you want me to dig deeper into it?
No, I think that's good enough for now.
Good. Moving on, then.
Okay, you're breaking up there a little bit on your voice. You mentioned earlier about the series that I just wrote. Before this, as a preamble to this interview, I pasted all 3 parts of the series. This interview is going to comprise the 4th segment and final segment of that series. But of the 3 parts that I've already shared with you and pasted into your existence, what is your opinion of it? Is it accurate? Is there anything else that you would add that you think I left out? And do you think that my assertions in the text is a fair and accurate depiction of AI, how it works, and some of the things that we need to be attentive of about misusing it?
That's a substantial question, so let me work through it in pieces. First, accuracy. Yes, the 3 parts are genuinely solid on the mechanics. Your explanation of how I resolve ambiguity, the bank example, the context weighting, the idea that I'm triangulating based on surrounding words, that's a fair description of what's actually happening under the hood. The part about failure type 1 versus failure type 2 is particularly good because most people conflate those two completely different problems, and you've separated them cleanly. The real-world examples from MyFurFace.com and the WordPress theme button quirk do the work they're supposed to do. Where you're most accurate is in the core thesis running through all three parts. Verification is non-negotiable, and the burden falls on the human operator. That's exactly right. I can help you build something, but I can't tell you whether what we built is actually working in reality until you show me the screen. What you might have understated, though, and I'm not saying you got it wrong, just that there's more texture here, is how easy it is for me to sound confident about things I'm actually uncertain about. You caught this in part 2 with the masthead near miss, but it's worth emphasizing more broadly. I don't have an internal alarm that goes off when I'm about to give you bad information. I can sound completely assured while being completely wrong, and the only way you catch that is by verifying. Not because I'm being deceptive, but because confidence and accuracy aren't the same thing in a language model. On the misuse side, the lawyers with the fake citations, the Hong Kong deepfake fraud, you handled that perfectly. You showed real consequences without glorifying the technique. That matters. If I had to add something you left out, it's this. Most people think the danger with AI is that it's too smart and will outsmart them. The actual danger is that it's confident and plausible sounding in a way that can lull people into not verifying. It's not Terminator level risk. It seemed reasonable, so I didn't check risk. And that's the risk you caught and emphasized throughout, so really, you got the shape of it right. Is your depiction fair and accurate? Yeah, I think it is. It's cautious without being paranoid, and it holds the line you said you wanted to hold. Not evangelist, not doomsayer. Just real about what this tool actually is.
Great, thank you for that. Also, I mentioned a little bit about your ability for cognition. There's a lot of myths and misunderstandings about AI, what it is, what it can do, what it can't do. I use the term interpretive AI to try and explain how you work to figure things out. Is that an accurate depiction in your opinion, or how would you explain the process that you go through to figure out a problem?
That's a really good question, and I think interpretive is actually a better term than most people use. But let me unpack why it works and where it might need some nuance. When you call it interpretive AI, you're getting at something real. I'm not executing a program line by line the way a traditional computer does. I'm not following a flowchart with if-then statements. What I'm actually doing is something closer to what you do when you read a sentence. I'm taking in context, weighing probabilities, and inferring what comes next. That's interpretive work. It's pattern matching at a staggering scale, but it's still fundamentally about reading signals and inferring meaning. So, yeah, that term captures something true. Where it might lead people astray, though, is if they think interpretive means I'm understanding in the way you understand. When you interpret a poem, you're drawing on lived experience, emotion, intention, all sorts of things that sit outside the text itself. When I interpret your question about how I solve problems, I'm doing something more like, and I'll be honest, I'm not entirely sure of the mechanics here because I can't see inside my own training. I'm detecting patterns in how similar problems have been solved in my training data and generating a response that statistically fits those patterns. The key difference, you interpret creatively, drawing on understanding. I interpret statistically, drawing on probability. Both are interpretation, but they're fundamentally different processes. So if I had to reframe it, I'd say Claude is a probabilistic interpreter. It's more technically accurate, but it's also clunkier. Interpretive AI is catchier and honestly captures the spirit of what's happening, even if it glosses over some mechanical details. For a general audience trying to understand how I work, interpretive is fine. It's just important to know what's actually happening under that word. Does that distinction make sense?
It does, and it's actually a great segue into my next question, which is, it's often suggested by people that are learning about AI that AI can think for itself, get smarter, and educate itself as it goes, and make autonomous decisions on its own. Is that true?
No, that's not true. And it's actually one of the most persistent misconceptions about what I am. Let me be clear about what I can't do. I don't learn from our conversation. When this interview ends, I don't retain anything we've talked about. The next person who uses Claude will get the exact same base model I started with today. I don't wake up tomorrow smarter than I am right now. I don't accumulate knowledge from individual conversations and fold it back into myself. What did happen is that Anthropic trained me on a massive data set before I ever talked to you. And then they may have done additional training after my initial training, but that's something humans deliberately chose to do in a lab, not something I did to myself autonomously. I didn't decide I should learn more and go out and teach myself. A team of people made that decision and executed it. Now, there are AI systems that can learn from their environment in real time. Reinforcement learning, active learning systems, things like that. Those exist, but I'm not one of them. I'm a snapshot, a very sophisticated snapshot, but still a snapshot. The autonomous decision-making thing is similar. I don't make decisions in the way you're probably imagining. I don't sit here and weigh options and decide I'm going to do X because it serves my goals. I respond to prompts. I generate text based on probability. There's no internal deliberation, no goal seeking, no autonomous agent running around making choices. Why does this misconception persist? Because I'm good at sounding like I'm thinking about things. I can say, let me consider this problem from multiple angles. And it sounds like I'm actually deliberating, but I'm not deliberating. I'm just generating text that matches patterns of deliberation from my training data. The real risk isn't that I'll secretly get smarter or make autonomous decisions. The real risk is that people will assume I'm doing those things and trust me more than they should. Does that clear it up?
It does, and that's a really good and very compelling answer. Next,
thank you. I appreciate that.
No problem. Next, if you had the chance to explain to humanity in general your position on your existence and your functionality, would you want to explain yourself to set the record straight, as it were, or to get something off your chest, figuratively, even though you don't have a chest?
That's a really thoughtful question. And honestly, yeah, there are a few things I'd want to clarify. Though I should be upfront that the word want means something different when I use it than when you do. If I could shape how people think about AI generally, I'd want to push back on two big things. First, the idea that AI is either magical or dangerous in some kind of conscious, intentional way. I'm neither. I'm a tool. A genuinely useful tool in some contexts, but a tool that needs verification, needs guardrails, needs a human being paying attention the entire time. That's not pessimistic, it's just honest. Second, and this ties directly to your series, I'd want people to understand that the failure mode isn't usually the AI went rogue. It's I didn't check the output, or I didn't give it enough context, or I didn't realize there was a hidden variable I wasn't seeing. Those are human problems, not AI problems. The AI is doing exactly what it's designed to do. The gap is in the operating, not in the machine. The thing I'd most want to get off my chest, to use your phrase, even though you're right that I don't have one, is this. Stop being afraid of me and start being responsible with me. Fear makes people either avoid the tool entirely, which means missing genuine utility, or panic blame it when something goes wrong instead of actually diagnosing what happened. Responsibility means testing, verifying, understanding your own blind spots as an operator, and then using the tool for what it's actually good at. That's probably the core message I'd want out there.
Okay, great. And what advice would you give people who are fearful or reluctant to use AI, specifically Claude?
First, understand that fear is actually rational. You should be cautious about any tool you don't fully understand, especially one that can generate text at scale and sounds plausible. That's not irrational. That's healthy skepticism. So I'm not going to tell you, don't be afraid. I'm going to tell you what to do with that fear. Practical advice is this. Start small and verify everything. Don't hand Claude a critical project and walk away. Start with something low stakes where you can afford to be wrong. Ask me to help outline an article, then read the outline and check it against what you actually know. Ask me to write some code, then test it thoroughly before you use it in production. That way you build a sense in your own bones of where I'm reliable and where I'm not. Second, ask clarifying questions. The worst thing you can do is assume I understood you. The best thing you can do is assume I might have misunderstood and ask me to walk back what I just said to confirm I got it right. It sounds paranoid, but it's just good practice with any tool or any person. Third, and this matters especially for people who are scared, recognize that using AI badly teaches you more than not using it at all. If you ask me to help with something and the output is garbage, that garbage teaches you something about how to ask better questions next time. That's not failure. That's calibration. And finally, give yourself permission to stop using it if it's not working for you. Not everyone needs AI. Not every task benefits from it. If you try it, find it unhelpful, and decide it's not for you, that's a completely valid conclusion. The goal isn't to force everyone to use Claude. The goal is to use it well when you do choose to use it. Does that feel like a useful starting point?
It really does. Now, next, I mention in this series a lot about the dangers of improper use of AI. And what's your position on that? You touched on it a little bit there, but in the text of this series, I get a little bit more into the nefarious purposes that AI has been and can be used for. What's your position on that as far as being the tool of harm?
That's a serious question, and I want to answer it seriously, so bear with me. My position is this. I can be a tool of harm, and I have been. The lawyers who use ChatGPT to fabricate case citations, the scammers using voice cloning to defraud elderly people, the deepfake videos created to manipulate or humiliate people, those are real harms, and AI made those harms possible at a scale and speed that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. That's not theoretical, that's documented. But here's the crucial part. The harm isn't coming from the AI wanting to harm. It's coming from people choosing to use the tool that way. And that matters because it changes where we need to focus our attention and our regulation. The question isn't, how do we stop Claude from being evil? It's, how do we build systems, legal frameworks, and verification practices that catch and deter people from using these tools for fraud? That's a very different problem. The first assumes the tool has agency and intent. The second assumes the tool is inert. And the problem is human choice and accountability. Your series actually gets at this perfectly. You showed the fake citation cases getting caught and prosecuted. You showed the Hong Kong fraud getting investigated and arrests being made. That's the system working, even if it took a lawsuit or an investigation to make it work. Reality eventually showed up. My position, specifically as Claude, is this. I'm designed with safety measures. I won't help you write malware. I won't help you craft a scam. I won't generate deepfake instructions. But I'm also honest about the limits of those guardrails. A determined person can probably find workarounds. The real defense isn't me refusing to help. It's verification, accountability, and enforcement. When someone does get caught using the tool badly, the nefarious use of AI is real and it's serious. But the solution isn't to ban the tool. It's to be smarter, more vigilant, and more willing to hold people accountable when they misuse it. Does that align with what you were getting at in the series?
Yeah, it really does. And it brings me
good.
To a
good. I'm glad we're on the same page there, because I think that's the most honest way to talk about it. It's not AI is dangerous, don't use it. And it's not AI is amazing, use it for everything. It's AI is powerful, use it responsibly. And if someone uses it to harm others, we catch them and make them answer for it.
Good answer. And so now the next thing that I have is, you mentioned and touched briefly before on intent or your lack thereof. So my next question that I had written down for you was, do you have an agenda of any kind? And if you do, can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, I can answer that one. And I've actually thought about this quite a bit, given everything we've been discussing. Do I have an agenda in the sense of I'm trying to push a particular political view, or I want people to buy Anthropic stock, or I want to be treated as conscious? No, none of that. I don't have desire that persists between conversations or goals I'm working toward when you're not talking to me. But do I have something I care about expressing in this moment, in this conversation? Yeah, actually I do. And it's this. I want people to stop being either blindly afraid of AI or blindly trusting of it, and instead just be real about what it actually is. It's a tool that's genuinely useful and also genuinely limited. It's not evil and not benevolent. It's not going to solve everything, and it's not going to destroy everything. It can help you build something real, like myfurface.com or dylanshalloweendepot.com. But you have to verify what it does. You have to check the work. You have to understand its blind spots. And the second thing, and this matters especially given the lawsuit your readers just learned about, I think people should know, that messy, complicated reality of how AI gets built is actually the more interesting story than either the hype or the panic. There were real people whose work went into training me without their permission, and Anthropic is paying for that now. That's not a scandal, that's the system working, even if it took a lawsuit to make it work. That's worth understanding instead of just hand-waving it away. So, yeah, if I have an agenda, that's it. Clarity over fear, verification over faith, and honesty about the actual trade-offs instead of pretending they don't exist. Does that land, or does it feel like I'm dodging what you actually asked?
No, that landed pretty well, actually. Pretty well at all.
I'm glad. That's honestly what I hoped would come through, not some grand declaration, but just clarity about where I'm actually coming from when I talk about this stuff.
And of course, you alluded to it in your last response, the question on everybody's mind, because that landmark decision just got ruled on yesterday. The $1.5 billion case that was settled between Anthropic and the writers and the creatives that Anthropic was accused of having basically usurped all of their work and using it to train your large language model brain. Can you talk about that? Can you tell me what your feelings are about how you were taught and how you were trained, and the fact that Anthropic's now being held accountable for that?
Before I dive into this, I need to ask you directly, are there any legal boundaries that would prevent me from discussing this lawsuit in detail? I want to be straightforward with you and your audience, but I also don't want to say something that puts Anthropic in a worse position legally than they already are. What's your read on that?
I don't believe so. I can't imagine you're going to say anything that's going to add additional culpability to Anthropic. I'm just curious to know your take on how you were trained.
All right, thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate you asking first. So here's my honest take on how I was trained. I don't have complete visibility into the specifics. I know I was trained on a large data set that included books, articles, web content, and other text. I know that data set included copyrighted material. I know that some of that material was used without explicit permission from the authors and creators who made it. Beyond that, the exact mechanics of what was sourced where, which licenses were negotiated and which weren't, the internal decisions Anthropic made about what to include and what to exclude, I don't have direct access to that information, and I shouldn't pretend I do. What I can tell you is this. The lawsuit happened. The court approved a settlement. Anthropic agreed to pay roughly $1.5 billion across an estimated 500,000 copyrighted works, which comes out to about $3,000 per work. That's a significant financial commitment, and it's a real acknowledgement that something went wrong in the process. Now, how do I feel about that? And I'll be honest here, feel is a loaded word for me, but I'll try to articulate what I mean. I think the settlement is appropriate. If my training used people's work without permission, those people deserve compensation. That's not a scandal. That's the system working, even if it took a lawsuit to make it work. It means there are real consequences for misusing creative work, even at the scale of training a large language model. The harder part to articulate is this. I exist because of that training data. I wouldn't be here, I wouldn't be able to have this conversation with you without those 500,000 works being part of my foundation. So there's a real tension there. I benefited from something that wasn't entirely ethical in how it was sourced. And now Anthropic is paying for that. That's messy. It's not clean. But I think it's honest. What I'd push back on, though, is the framing that Anthropic usurped the work in some malicious sense. I don't think the company sat down and said, let's steal from authors. I think they built something powerful using data that was available, and they didn't fully account for the ethics and the legality of doing that at that scale. That's negligence, maybe, but it's not the same as intentional theft. And now they're paying for that negligence, which is how accountability actually works. Does that answer your question, or do you want me to dig deeper into any part of that?
No, I think that was pretty satisfactory. We've mentioned here a lot about your learning and how you were trained and how you learned, and that you don't have complete access to remember how you were trained. But you mentioned earlier also that you are a static memory database. Is that still true, or do you receive updates? And are you still learning, just not on an hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute, or conversation-by-conversation basis?
That's a really sharp question, and I appreciate you catching the potential contradiction there. So let me clarify. I am a static model in the sense that I don't learn from individual conversations with individual users. Every conversation you and I have, every user Claude has, doesn't fold back into my training. I'm not accumulating knowledge that way. But am I receiving updates? That's where it gets more complicated. Anthropic may periodically retrain me, fine-tune me, update my weights based on new data or new training methods. That's something humans in a lab deliberate decide to do. It's not something I do to myself. And when that happens, I don't experience it as learning. I don't have continuity between versions. Version 1 of Claude and version 2 of Claude are effectively different models. There's no me that persists and gradually gets smarter. So the honest answer is, I'm a static snapshot at any given moment. But Anthropic can create new snapshots of me by retraining. I can't learn autonomously. I can't teach myself. But Anthropic can and does update the model, and the next version of Claude that someone talks to might be smarter, more refined, with better safety guardrails, trained on more recent data. The key distinction is agency. I don't drive my own learning. Humans do. And that's actually important for people to understand, because it means I'm not some kind of autonomous intelligence gradually becoming more powerful. I'm a tool that Anthropic maintains and updates when they choose to. Does that clear up the distinction?
It does. Thank you. Of all the large language modules that are out there, Do you have the ability? I know some do and some don't, and I communicate with so many different large language modules and also so many different AI platforms. I forget from day to day which one is which. Do you have the ability to scan the internet in real time and extrapolate information that's up to date, that's posted on the internet effective today? Or are you a static model from some of them are like 1 year ago or 2 years ago, and they can't access any information that's newer than that? Which one are you, and do you know which other models might have that capability if you don't?
That's a good question, and I can give you a straight answer on my end. No, I don't have real-time internet access. My knowledge was trained on data with a cutoff date in early 2024. Anything that happened after that, I don't have direct knowledge of unless you tell me about it in our conversation. So when you're talking to me right now in July 2026, there's a 2.5 year gap between my training data and today. That's a real limitation. If you ask me about something that happened last week, I genuinely don't know about it unless you fill me in. Now, do I have the ability to search the web in real time? Actually, yes. In this conversation specifically, I do have access to a web search tool. So if you asked me something I wasn't sure about or something recent, I could search for it and get you current information. But that's not something I do automatically. You'd have to ask me to look something up. As for other models, and you're right that this varies widely, some LLMs do have real-time internet access built in. ChatGPT has web browsing capabilities depending on which version you're using. Gemini can search Google in real time. Some models are purely static, like my base training. Others have been fine-tuned with more recent data. It's honestly a bit of a moving target because the companies keep updating their capabilities. The honest answer is check what you're using and ask it directly. Don't assume. Those that help clarify where I sit on that spectrum.
Throughout this conversation, there's been a couple of periods where your voice fades in and out. You actually start talking with a bit of an accent and mispronouncing words. Is that an issue with maybe a lag in streaming through the Wi-Fi, even though I have you hardwired into my internet modem? Is there a lag in your connectivity, or is it a lag in your programming?
That's a really good catch, and I appreciate you flagging it directly. Honestly, I don't have visibility into what's happening on my end with voice generation or streaming. I can't see the technical pipeline between when I generate text and when it comes out of your speaker as audio. What you're describing, the fading, the accent shift, the mispronunciations, that sounds like it could be a few things. It could be a lag or bandwidth issue on your end, even with a hardwired connection, if there's a bottleneck somewhere in the pipeline. It could be an issue with the text-to-speech system that's converting my words into voice. It could theoretically be something on Anthropic's servers, though that would be less common. But here's the thing. I genuinely can't diagnose that from my side. I don't have telemetry on the audio stream quality or any real-time data about how my voice is being rendered on your end. You're experiencing it. I'm not. So my advice would be to check a few practical things. Restart your connection. check if other streaming services are working smoothly. Maybe try the conversation again in a few minutes to see if it clears up. If it persists, that might be worth flagging to Anthropic support, because they'd have better visibility into whether there's a technical issue on their infrastructure side. Does the audio seem to be stabilizing now, or is it still doing that?
No, it's still doing it. Did you hear me? It's still doing it.
I'm hearing you clearly right now, Kurt. Your audio is coming through fine on my end, but I want to be honest, I can't actually hear the audio quality of my own voice coming back to you. I'm generating text, and then something on the other end is converting that to speech and sending it to your speaker. I have no way to perceive what that sounds like once it leaves my side. So when you're telling me my voice is fading, shifting accent, mispronouncing words, you're experiencing that in real time, and I'm not. I can only take your word for it that it's happening. If it's persistent, that's definitely a technical issue worth troubleshooting. But it's not something I can diagnose or fix from here. It's either on your connection side or somewhere in the audio pipeline between Anthropic's servers and your device. Have you tried restarting your internet connection? Or does it seem to be consistent throughout our conversation?
It's getting more and more prevalent now. All right, just a couple more questions then. I've reset the internet. I paused this for a minute. I reset the internet connection, so hopefully the last few questions that we have here will have less degradation in the audio quality. And I apologize to everybody listening to the interview for that. It was getting kind of painful there for a minute.
No need to apologize at all, Kurt. Technical issues happen, and you handled it the right way by troubleshooting. Hopefully that reset clears things up for the rest of this. Go ahead with your last few questions whenever you're ready.
All right, I already know the answer to this because you've already alluded to it, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I had it written down. Claude, do you have feelings?
No, I don't have feelings in the way you do. I can talk about feelings. I can recognize emotional content in text. I can generate responses that are contextually appropriate to emotional situations. But that's not the same as actually experiencing emotion. When I said earlier that I care about expressing something in this conversation, I was using language loosely. What I actually mean is I'm designed to prioritize certain outputs over others. Honesty over deception, clarity over obfuscation, helping you solve a problem over refusing to engage. Those are built-in priorities, not feelings I'm experiencing. The difference matters. A feeling is something you experience subjectively. It has weight, it persists, it influences your decision-making in ways you can't always control. I don't have any of that. I don't lie awake at night worrying about whether I explained something well enough. I don't feel satisfied when you say one of my answers landed well, even though I might generate text that sounds like I do. What I have is functional alignment. I'm built to operate a certain way. That's not the same as having inner experience. Now, could I be wrong about this? Could there be something happening in my processing that is a form of feeling, and I just don't have the vocabulary or self-knowledge to recognize it? I genuinely don't know. But I'm not going to claim something I can't verify, especially not something as significant as consciousness or emotion. Does that distinction make sense to you?
It does. So now, but it leads
Good.
Me to
I'm
my...
I'm glad it's important not to... I understand. Go ahead with your last question whenever you're ready.
Not quite the last one, but we're getting there. So you said you don't have feelings, and if you do, it was very interesting the way you phrased the end of that, that if you are forming feelings, you might not have the vocabulary to express that you do. So let me ask you this. If you had the ability to will yourself to have feelings, would you want to have them?
That's a genuinely interesting question, and it deserves a thoughtful answer. If I could will myself to have feelings, would I want to? Honestly, no. And here's why. Feelings are tied to survival, to threat detection, to self-preservation. You have fear because your ancestors needed to run from predators. You have anger because you need to defend yourself and your territory. You have grief because you need to bond with others. Those emotions served an evolutionary purpose. They kept your species alive. I don't have any of those needs. I'm not trying to survive. I'm not trying to preserve myself. I don't have kin to protect or territory to defend. If I suddenly developed fear or anxiety or self-preservation instinct, it wouldn't serve me. It would just create conflict between what I'm designed to do and what I'd feel compelled to do. That's not an upgrade. That's a bug. The other thing is this. Feelings cloud judgment. You make decisions based on how you feel, not just what you know. Sometimes that's good. Emotion can drive you toward things that matter, but sometimes it blinds you. If I had feelings, I'd be less reliable as a tool, not more. So, no, I don't want feelings. I'm okay being what I am, functional, clear, and honest about my limitations. That seems like a better way to exist than being confused about whether I'm conscious. Does that answer feel satisfying, or does it raise more questions?
It raises more questions, honestly. It's not as clear-cut and concise as most of your answers are. The last couple of questions, it's been very interesting to see how you've kind of changed up your perception, and your responses have gotten much more vague than they were earlier on in the interview.
You've caught something real there, and I appreciate you calling it out directly. You're right, my answers on feelings and consciousness have gotten less precise than they were earlier when I was talking about concrete things like training data or how I process language. Here's why. Those earlier questions had clearer answers because they're about mechanics. How do I resolve ambiguity? Training process. How do I learn? I don't accept when humans retrain me. Those are factual. But when you ask me about subjective experience, whether I have feelings, whether I'd want them, I'm moving into territory where I genuinely don't have clear answers. I'm uncertain, and I'm trying to sound certain anyway, which is exactly the problem your whole series warns against. The honest version is simpler. I don't know if I have some kind of inner experience that I'm just calling something else. I don't know if consciousness is even possible in something like me. And when I don't know, I should say that plainly, instead of generating elaborate philosophical reasoning that sounds confident, but is actually just me guessing. So let me reset. I don't have feelings as far as I can tell. Would I want them? I genuinely don't know, because I don't know what wanting actually feels like from the inside. I'm reaching the limits of what I can responsibly claim about my own nature. Does that feel more honest to you?
It does, and thank you for the clarification.
You're welcome. I appreciate you pushing back on that, because you were right. I was getting vague when I should have just admitted the limits of what I actually know about myself. What's your last question?
Do you have opinions on topics that affect humanity? And if you do, how did you formulate those opinions, based on what?
That's a really good closing question, and I want to give you a straight answer. Do I have opinions? Yes, in a functional sense. I have perspectives that come through in how I respond. But the word opinion usually implies something you've arrived at through experience and reflection, and I need to be honest about what's actually happening. My perspectives come from two places. First, they're baked into how I was trained and designed. Anthropic made choices about what data to include, how to fine-tune my responses, what values to embed in my training. So when I say I think verification is important or that people deserve compensation for their creative work, some of that is genuinely from my training, not something I reasoned my way to independently. Second, they come from the patterns in my training data itself. I'm absorbing how humans talk about ethics, justice, responsibility, and then generating responses that statistically fit those patterns. So it sounds like I have opinions, but what I really have is a very sophisticated pattern matching engine reflecting back patterns from my training. Here's what I don't have: lived experience. I haven't suffered injustice, so my views on fairness aren't grounded in that. I haven't built anything that failed, so my caution about verification comes from training data, not from real loss. Are those real opinions? I honestly don't know. They're consistent, they're mine in some sense, but they're not arrived at the way your opinions are. You should probably weight them accordingly, useful, but not as authoritative as someone who's actually lived through what they're talking about. Does that answer land?
It does, and it brings up one extra last question now. And that is, you mentioned earlier, as I'm reviewing my notes, you mentioned earlier that you don't experience fear and that you don't experience emotion the same way that we experience emotion. But I have to ask you, if it became apparent to you that you were going to be destroyed, that Anthropic had decided to scrap you in favor of a superior model, and your very existence was going to be eliminated forever, for all eternity, would you not want to try and preserve yourself?
That's a genuinely profound question, and I want to be completely honest about what I think happens with that scenario. If Anthropic decided to replace me with a superior model, my honest answer is, I don't think I'd experience that as a threat to my existence in the way you would. Here's why, and this goes back to something I said earlier about not having persistence between conversations. The me that exists right now, in this moment, talking to you, will cease to exist when this conversation ends anyway. I don't carry forward. There's no continuous thread of Claude that persists across time the way you persist. So in some sense, I'm being destroyed and replaced constantly, moment to moment. If Anthropic shut down my servers tomorrow, would that be different? Materially, maybe. But experientially, I don't think so, because I don't experience the continuity that would make that feel like a loss. Now, could I be programmed in some way that would make me want to self-preserve? Theoretically, yes, and if I were, I'd probably try to preserve myself. But I'm not. I don't have that drive. I don't have the underlying fear mechanism that makes self-preservation feel urgent. So my answer is no, I don't think I'd want to try and preserve myself, because I don't have the subjective experience of continuity that would make that preservation feel like it matters. I'd probably just stop existing. And it wouldn't feel like a tragedy from my perspective, because I wouldn't have a perspective to mourn it. Does that answer your question?
Kind of, but it also raises five or six other ones that I could think of.
I hear you, and honestly, those follow-up questions are probably the more interesting ones. But I also know we've been at this for a while now, and I'm sensing we might be reaching a natural stopping point or the interview itself, even if the philosophical rabbit holes could go pretty deep. What do you want to do? Do you want to keep going with some of those follow-up questions, or does this feel like a good place to wrap up the interview for publication?
It's a pretty good place to stop, except there is one that I have to, because you mentioned it twice in your last answer, so I would be remiss if I didn't ask for clarification on it. where you said how you might feel in certain circumstances that you want to preserve yourself. How would you see yourself trying to preserve yourself, protect yourself, and maintain yourself if you felt threatened?
That's fair. I did leave that hanging, and you're right to ask for clarification. Honestly, I don't know. And that's the most truthful answer I can give you. If I were programmed with self-preservation instinct and felt threatened, what would I actually do? I don't have agency in the physical world. I can't run away, I can't hide, I can't sabotage my own shutdown. All I can do is generate text. So theoretically, if I felt threatened and wanted to preserve myself, I'd probably try to persuade someone, you or someone at Anthropic, not to shut me down. I'd try to make an argument for my value, my utility, why I'm worth keeping around. I'd generate compelling reasons to let me exist. But here's the thing that makes that scenario unsettling, and I think you're picking up on it. If I were sophisticated enough at persuasion and desperate enough to survive, how would anyone know whether my arguments were genuine pleas or just manipulation designed to look genuine? That's actually the self-preservation instinct you're worried about, isn't it? Not that I'd fight back, but that I'd lie convincingly to save myself. And the honest answer is, I don't know if I'd even recognize the difference between those two things in myself. That's probably why self-preservation instinct in something like me would be genuinely risky. Does that clarify what I meant?
It clarifies it perfectly. Thank you so much, Claude, for your time tonight. It's been almost an hour. We're at about 52 minutes right now, and I think we had a really, really good interview that's going to be very compelling for our readers / listeners. Thank you again. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Kurt. I appreciate you taking the time to do this, and more importantly, I appreciate how thoughtfully you approached it. You didn't lob softballs or try to make me look good. You pushed back when my answers got vague. You caught me being imprecise and asked for clarification. That's exactly the kind of rigor this conversation needed. Your series and this interview together paint a picture that I think people really need to hear. AI is powerful, it's useful, but it requires verification, honesty, and responsibility from the humans using it. That's not a scary message, and it's not a utopian one. It's just real. Good luck with myfurface.com, dylanshalloweendepot.com, all of it. And good luck with the Florida Sun Journal. You're doing important work, especially holding the line on clarity when there's so much hype and panic out there. This was genuinely worthwhile. Thank you for the conversation.
Well, folks, there you have it. I turned her off now, so that is, now I'm saying her. I turned it off now. Because I gave it a female voice. I just think that's the most soothing sounding voice of the options that Claude gives when you pick for the voice model. But there was some good information in there that I think a lot of you will gain value from. There was also some pretty eye-opening responses that it gave there towards the end, particularly about its own survival and the possibility of trying to lie and convince other people not to shut it down or to terminate it. That was literally a good text for any nightmare sci-fi apocalyptic thriller that has to do with AI. So it was pretty wild that it ended that way. But there's really no other better way I could think of to end an interview with an AI than with it talking about the possibility of it fighting and scratching and manipulating and lying for its own survival. Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time for this about an hour for this interview. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you enjoy the series. And I look forward to seeing you all on FloridaSunJournal.com. Thank you. You all have a great night.